Welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast, where we amplify the stories of regular people practicing anti-racism in their everyday lives. Every single one of us has the ability to create real and meaningful change right where we are. I'm your host, Carrie Sawyer, and I've got the stories to prove it. I can't wait to introduce you to these people, these change leaders, people who saw a need and decided to take action. To me, this is so inspiring, showing the powerful idea of everyday activism. I hope that you take away at least some small inspiration and use it to act and create more good in your world too. Let's get started, y'all.
Hi, everyone. I am Kaseba, your honorary First Inclusion Project podcast host. Welcome back to another episode of the First Inclusion Project podcast, College Takeover, All Things Inclusive Edition, where I'm having thoughtful conversations with some amazing college pals with the hopes of inspiring you all to engage in conversations and actions that will create a more inclusive world. Today, we're going to be talking about student disability justices at colleges with my guest, Maddie.
Hi, I'm Maddie Beadle. I am going to be a junior at Pepperdine University. I'm a poli-sci major with a minor in social work and have a big passion for disabled rights and disabled justice.
Perfect. Thank you so much for joining us. So we're going to get right into this episode. So students with disabilities and inclusivity are often left out of conversations regarding change in our education systems and society as a whole, which is why I'm so excited that we are able to have this conversation today and shed light on some of these issues. You have personal experience with having a disability and navigating the education system. Can you talk about what your disability is and how it has affected you?
Yes, of course. So my main condition is hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a genetic connective tissue disorder that affects my connective tissue because I have defective collagen production. So that basically makes anything in my body with connective tissue work a little bit different than normal, which can cause me to have subluxations and dislocations of joints for little to no reason, which can make getting around a little bit difficult. For the most of my life, I've been pretty active, and that kind of keeps things at bay. But there's different stages of the condition, and they can get worse for little to no reason. But it is genetic, and you're inherited from your family. But other than the hypermobility that comes with it, the things that really change and impact your life, especially on a college campus, aren't necessarily just that, but all the other conditions that come with it. So 75% of people with HEDS, which is the acronym for it, have stomach issues. Or, for example, people deal with migraines, headaches, chronic fatigue, which being a college student, that really impacts what you do because, as you know, on a college campus, everything is go, go, go. We have little time for self-care, you know what I mean? Let alone if you're someone who needs a little bit extra.
Would you say, because, you know, we are at a college campus and, you know, it's something where we as students have to communicate things with our professors individually, which is something different than high school, middle school, where once you kind of alert the school in one way, it kind of trickles down to all of your teachers. Do you think that professors take these kinds of things seriously? Because you said that it could cause stomach issues, which I'm assuming sometimes, depending on how an individual feels, you might not necessarily be able to get to class or attend your activities.
100%. I mean, we have a office that we can, you know, register with, but like you said, you have to talk to those professors individually and follow up with those things. It's definitely a toss-up. Some teachers, some professors are very accommodating, and some are kind of like, if you're not here, you're not getting the material and that's it. Fortunately, I've been very lucky to have professors who have been understanding when I can't get to class, or it takes me a little bit longer to get to class, or if I have to leave class. And that's for a multitude of reasons, like you said, with stomach issues, but even sometimes I have to leave to like call a doctor because I need to make an appointment because you can only call during a certain period of time. And some teachers have been really understanding, but it's really a toss up. And I really think that's not something you should have to deal with in terms of your education, especially in the US where it does cost a considerable amount of money to be a college student.
It does. Would you say that this lack of understanding or empathy on their end comes from not having the proper knowledge of what these disabilities are and how they actually impact students? Because some of the other issues that you're saying that come along with these disabilities to people who I feel like are ignorant, kind of like, well, everyone gets sick, and so why don't you just show up or, you know, figure it out?
100%. And even to the vein of what you're just saying, we do show up. Like, most of the time we feel horrible, at least I do, but I do show up more than, you know, the average person who gets sick once in a while. Most of the time I am sick and still show up to class. But I think you're saying, what you're saying with the ignorance is definitely true. And the visible fact that you can't see my disability adds to it immensely, because then it's like, oh, are you just using this to get out of class? Do you actually feel that way? Well, you know, you look abled or not disabled, so you could be making it up. So there's all these other things where it's kind of like, not only those people see, like, you look to be fine, so you should be fine. And then along that comes with that is like this imposter syndrome, like, am I too sick to go to class? Or, you know what I mean? So it's just a whole cycle that is, you know, built on ignorance, as you were saying.
And I'm glad that you brought up, you know, having a disability that you cannot necessarily see with the eye. Mm-hmm. Because while growing up, I went to public school up until second grade, and kids with disabilities were separated from the class and taken to the other side of campus for long periods of the day, including recess and lunches. Then when I switched over to private school, all of the kids were in the same class due to smaller classes, you know, having one class per grade. And kids with disabilities were given extra time for tests, and it was the same thing throughout high school and college. Do you think inclusion in the classroom for students with and without disabilities benefits everyone? Why or why not?
Short answer, yes, it benefits everyone. And especially with what we were just talking about, we all know at this point in our lives that prejudice isn't born, it's made. So when you're sitting in a classroom and you know that these people are being taken out for a specific reason, you find those differences, and kids do. And if the teacher decides, you know, to model that they can't handle these children, or that they're too different, that they need to go to these special classes, which special is also a huge issue in the community of differentiating people, you know, even neurodivergent children or children with unseen disabilities to even physical disabilities. And I think it's just overall a hindrance to building a community and bridging the gap between the disabled and non-disabled community.
Yeah, because I'm glad that you even mentioned that, because for me, I remember when I would come home from school and I would ask my mom, you know, certain questions of, like, they take these kids out and I don't know where they're going or, you know, for what. But my mom has a background in the medical field. She's a registered nurse, so she has a lot of knowledge on a bunch of disabilities. And, you know, luckily for me, she was able to sit down and have these conversations with me and say, you know, does it make you any better or them any less than you are? So for me, from that day forward, I never saw anyone with disabilities, whether I could see it or not, as anything different. But I was just thinking about, well, this is just my circumstance. I was blessed to have a mother that has this knowledge so I could get, you know, rid of my ignorance. But there's a whole lot of people who are going home, or even like you said, with the way teachers handle these things, they kind of just, there is no explanation, there's no conversation about it. It's just that, well, some people struggle with their schoolwork and just need extra time.
Yeah, of course. And that's not always like the full, you know, reason. And for children to understand what's going on, like you said, it's unspoken. They just leave and no one knows where they go. You know what I mean? And that's kind of insane, you know? But if we took these times, like these moments, as teachable moments, and even to the extent of like asking the child, is it okay if we explain to the class like what your disability is? Because then we'd have so much more understanding people in the world to go out and know, meet someone, and maybe they're scared to talk about their disability or feel ashamed of it. And to have that person who has been taught from a very young age, you know, we all have differences, and that's amazing. And actually knows about that person's experience. I mean, that creates a completely different society than we go into every single day.
Right, which goes back to, you know, what you said earlier about people were not born with the ignorance and hatred for some of these things. It's taught. And I've seen a lot of articles regarding disability justice for students and parents, you know, basically saying, well, we don't really want our kids to know about this because we don't want them to have some paranoia or fear that, you know, they're going to get this a disability. What are your thoughts on that? Like, how should parents be, one, handling this and having this conversation?
I mean, obviously, those parents are coming from a place of fear. And, you know, that fear comes from somewhere. And like we were talking about, it was obviously taught to them. And I think that that also comes from the fact that, like, disability in general, like, as a marginalized group, is often felt to as feared, because it's like, it reminds a lot of, this is morbid, but it reminds people of death, because everyone will become disabled at some point, most people in old age. But to talk about someone in their youth struggling with disability is a lot for non-disabled people to come to terms with, especially with their children. And I think that it doesn't breed paranoia, it actually breeds more understanding, because then these children won't be scared of the possibility that that may happen to them. I think that they would then understand what it's like, and that it's a normal way of life that many people live.
Right, absolutely. And so how does education inequality in schools lead to inequality in other areas of life for people with disabilities?
It impacts every aspect of the person's life. I mean, we have a lot of big talk about how these programs are, you know, the best thing since sliced bread, you know, for disabled students. And on paper, they look really great. But in practice, they're underfunded most of the time. The teachers are ill-equipped. The rate of which teachers in these systems and these classrooms quit is exceptionally high because of burnout, lack of support, things like that. And that impacts the students greatly, because if the teachers aren't supported, how are the students supported? And of course, I believe that students might need more equitable education rather than equal, because obviously there are students with different needs like myself in the classroom, in the setting, just not only the physical setting, but, you know, the intellectual setting of what's going on. But I think that serves everybody. I don't think that even non-disabled students or neurotypical students couldn't benefit from different forms of education being thrown at them, because I think we're in a very cookie cutter form of that, where we're all supposed to ascribe to a certain way of teaching. And I think that that's also detrimental to children as a whole. But yeah, all aspects of life. And one thing in particular that I like to talk about specifically surrounding this is subminimum wage. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
Well, you can go ahead and elaborate. I'm familiar with it, but you can go ahead and elaborate for the listeners in case people don't know, so that they're not just like, what is that?
Of course. Yeah. So subminimum wage is the legal ability to pay someone with a disability less than their non-disabled counterparts. And so with schooling being segregated with just disabled students, or a majority of the time with just disabled students, a lot of the time they're given less rigorous work because they're, you know, told that they've only can exceed a certain level of education, which is completely false. I mean, we've seen so many examples of how that's not the case. And so often I read somewhere that it was about 66% of students with disabilities will graduate high school on time, which is a staggering statistic, and that impacts you through college. And so if you're not been given the opportunity, or even being told that you could go to college, then you end up in jobs subminimum wage. And a lot of schools will funnel into those programs. And that's detrimental because those students are in a cycle of not being able to support themselves, in a cycle of lack of independence. And depending on other people, which is not the fate for all disabled people. I mean, for one thing, you know, that's something that the disabled community wants the most is self-sufficiency. I mean, being able to support themselves, you know what I mean? And even if you have to have some sort of aid or someone there, but you want to be the one employing them, you know what I mean? It's having, you know, that bodily autonomy, even if you don't necessarily fully have it physically or mentally. And those programs and the inequities and equalities of education feed into that lack of independence that disabled people are given.
Right. Thank you so much for that explanation. You touched on earlier about there being an issue with special education, like that term special. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same situation with like how like the things that we need are seen as accommodation. Like we're giving these to you because we're so gracious. You know what I mean? And it's, oh, we have these special classes for you because, you know, you're different. And so we have to accommodate you. And that's good of us. You know, it's this kind of like, it's this kind of tragic and othering word that people use. And for a while that was kind of like the PC term. And I think that's so interesting because it's clear that like the disabled community was not consulted on the verbiage used to describe them. And I think that's the biggest issue is that, you know, people might not have an issue, people might, but it's that that person is consulted and knowing that each person has the right to define like what they are labeled as because it's their life and it's their disability. And so, yeah, in the recent years, a lot of verbiage in the way that we've been talked about has been called into question. But I think special education needs to be eradicated like now.
And when those conversations happen, to have people with disabilities in the room in those conversations.
Yes, 100%. They need a seat at the table, even if people don't think that they deserve to be at the table.
Absolutely. So what barriers have you seen specifically in your college community that have prevented the inclusion of people with disabilities?
So namely, in architecture. So the way that my school is built, like I said, I go to Pepperdine. And if anybody's ever been on that campus, they know it's mostly hills and stairs. And it was built, most of the campus was built in the 70s. So they get out of a lot of like ADA requirements because that was in 1990. So some buildings don't have elevators. So if you need a dorm with access, you have to pick from a certain amount of dorms. Certain classrooms are really hard to get to. And things like that. And even for me, I don't use a mobility aid, which is a wheelchair, a knee scooter, you know, a cane, things like that. But even just the stairs constantly in the hills has been really draining and impacting on me. So I can't imagine someone using those things getting around campus. And I do have friends that have done it, but they've all been temporary because for someone to be permanently using a mobility aid on my campus would be a horrible existence. I'll just put it that way. You can do it. And that's the thing about our community is we're amazingly resilient, but the amount of pressure it puts on your mental and physical health is something that I wouldn't put anyone through.
And what are the things that your school has been doing right to support the inclusivity of students with disabilities?
I'm part of a committee that talks with admin. And so we have been able to have meetings with higher officials at our school to discuss our needs and discuss the issues that we've seen on campus. And, you know, the fact that they're having those meetings is really great. I think that that is important. But what we have moved forward in the past couple of years hasn't been super great. But they do hire a lot of amazing people within different offices within the school. So namely, we've partnered with the Office for Spiritual Life, and they've been really supportive, and they fund our Disability Awareness Week, which we had this past year for the first time in person, and things like that. So it's more not that the institution itself is necessarily supportive, but that there are people and offices within the institution that are supportive. And I'll give the school credit for hiring those people because they have made my experience on campus so much better.
And that's great because the one thing that I think all institutions need to support are hiring people that will provide resources and support that can aid right now in the moment before they can get to all of these other things. Like you said, with architecture, it should be done. It most definitely should be done, but it's definitely something that is going to take a while. And we know what happens when they start having conversations with finances and all of that, all of that good stuff. So it's good that they even have people so that, you know, you're able to at least find out what things you have access to right here, right now to help better your experience. What are the things that we can do to assist in the disability rights movements? Like, you know, what are the things that we should be questioning and looking for when we're around public spaces, when we're on campus.
100%. So I liked what you said, what should we be looking for? And a lot. I mean, I didn't notice. I mean, I grew up having disabled family members, so I knew what it was like to have someone with mobility issues that I had to look out for in my family. But I really didn't notice those things until I had her with me. And so now that I'm the person that's dealing with these things, I see things a lot more. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's a violation of this law, and that is not accessible, and things like that. So I think that for not the non-disabled communities, our allies, is looking out for those things and knowing when it's time to say something and stand with our community, because it's really easy when our community is just made up of disabled people or people with disabilities, depends on your verbiage there, to kind of push us aside and be like, that's a them problem, you know, no one else cares about it, you know, it's just them. Where when we have allies from different communities coming together and saying, no, this is an us problem, because we're all part of this beloved community where we support each other and this matters to all of us, then you see a lot more things changing. You know what I mean? Like the solidarity between it. And I think that's the idea behind New Wave Disability Rights, which is the disability justice movement, is that, you know, our liberation is collective and it's bound up in each of us and each other across different groups, across different people. And that is necessary in order for all of us to get what we need. And so we have to stand on that, and that we have to have solidarity. So I think that that's a big thing, like what you're saying, is to look around and see, you know, what's going on here. And then the same vein as that is education, you know, because a lot of people, I'm sure you're familiar with some of the happenings of the disability rights movement, but for the most part, you would be shocked when I say ableism and people say, what's that? It is a amount of people that are just like, I don't know what that is, but it is so real. And it happens on a regular basis, even in just regular things we say, you know, we're subliminally ableist because that's how we're trained to be. But yeah, knowing about those things, even knowing that this month is Disability Pride Month, woohoo, that's July, that when regular Pride
Month. See, and that's the first time I'm hearing that.
Really? Yeah. And that's a very normal thing. But when Pride Month ends, Disability Pride Month begins. And, you know, there is no brand deals. There is no, you know, our flag's known by very few people. You know what I mean? But we're there.
Didn't even know the disability rights movement had a flag. See, I'm learning something new. I'm learning so many new things right now that I'm just like, now I want to go back to my campus and say, what's going on? Where is this at? Because I recently served on student government, and that was the first time that I was really involved and introduced to the disability rights movement, because I had to check my own, you know, biases and check myself with the times that I've been ableist and the things that I've, you know, said that you don't think is harmful, but it's beyond more than harmful. And I think that it's just so important with, you know, the college transition, as I'm sure you know, it's already complex as it is with just, you know, going to college, that transition, young adulthood, and figuring out things for yourself, yet alone all of these other factors that I don't think about. I don't think twice about having to go up and down the stairs, you know, in a building other than like, yeah, an elevator would be nice, but not thinking about how that actually does, you know, affect other people and the way that, you know, you get to classes and just even, you know, carrying your backpack if it's heavy, all of these little things that we do not think about, you know, when going to class. So I really had to sit there and unpack a lot of my thoughts and verbiage and just really have to sit with the fact that, like, you know, this is not okay, and that, you know, learning how to be an ally, mm-hmm. a proper ally to the community, because we should all have a somewhat decent experience. Like, it shouldn't be hard if it doesn't have to be.
No. Yeah, that's a great point. It shouldn't be hard if it, yeah. And like, that's a thing, like a lot of people are like, well, it's just a little bit more difficult for you, but you can do it, just, you know, overcome. But like you're saying, it shouldn't be hard, and it doesn't have to be. you know, we are resilient, but we don't always have to have that, you know, game face on, let me fight the world. You know what I mean? That shouldn't
right,
be the
case, yeah.
That you're constantly in fight mode all the time, you know?
Because earlier you said that, you know, we don't really necessarily have the time for self-care and that you tend to show up even when you feel sick. And I feel like that just completely contradicts the whole, you know when to rest culture. You can't do that if you're not in the position to be able to do that.
Yeah, 100%. And I have to choose a lot of time. Like, I mean, we went to the same high school, so you know, it was rigorous education, but I wasn't dealing
it was,
with
yeah.
at that point. So I could choose, you know, not sleeping. I can choose, you know how it was. But in high school, in college now, dealing with disability and the onset of that, sometimes I'm like, yeah, I can't do this assignment right now. I have to practice self-care, you know? And choosing your health before everything else is not something we are trained to do as students. It is school
yeah, and especially,
over everything.
And especially for us from the environment that we came from, it was always, you know, school comes first. And when it comes to school, we were doing the absolute most. Like,
yes.
We were on go on a different level. So even just learning how to take a step back and not put so many things on our plate, that was a lot to have to learn getting to college. You feel almost guilty sometimes even saying that. Like, there's no way in high school, the thought of not doing an assignment would not even cross my mind.
Yeah, and so that's the situation. I mean, I rarely do that where I just push it off a little bit, you know, wait till the last minute. But sometimes that's what you have to do, you know, and I don't have the choice. Like, a lot of people in college also just throw away self-care, non-disabled, anybody. And I don't have that choice. So I have to learn self-care because it's completely unrealistic. It's not realistic for me to just keep going and going and going. You know, there's burnout there, and it's way worse for me and other disabled students than it is for everyone else, because you're not only balancing school, you're balancing your health. And that means a multitude of doctors all the time being poked with needles left and right. I mean, that's a completely new thing for someone so young to start to deal with. It's just one thing that you have to learn as, you know, being part of the disabled community is self-care. And you do feel guilty. You're like, wow, like, I could be doing all these things. But you really have to learn how to be satisfied with what you accomplish, because what you accomplish is amazing no matter how much you get done any day.
If there is one thing you would like the listeners to take away from this conversation, what would it be?
I would say to have more understanding, you know, to, when you enter a room, when you enter a space, erase that, those preconceived notions that you have, and especially about the disabled community. Really make an effort to learn about our heroes like Judy Heumann and Mia Mingus, and learn about all that these people have done just to be able to sit in a classroom next to you, you know, to learn the same things that you're learning, to have a space in a university, because that wasn't the case. And that wasn't the case not very long ago. I mean, civil rights for us, you know, 1990, that's when the ADA was passed. So we know from previous movements, you know, women's rights movements, the civil rights movements of 1960s, 50s, that work is not done. There is still sexism, there is still racism, you know.
Absolutely, yeah,
definitely. And that's the same for ableism, because it was just 30 something years ago, 30 plus years ago, that we got those civil rights. So you know that is simmering under the surface in people that you wouldn't even expect to have these prejudices. So like you're saying, just check those, and to understand, you know, what I learned about this is not that much, and I should educate myself, because there's disabled people in almost every single space you walk into, whether it's in
yeah, and you don't, and we don't know sometimes because we've been conditioned to mm-hmm. the disabilities that we can see.
Yes.
So I can't even imagine, you know, because we do have to be honest, the harm that some of us have contributed to by the things that we say with people in the room, because again, nobody has to disclose
no.
whatever they choose to disclose if they don't want to. So that's why it's just important to just get rid of it and not do it and not do it at all.
Yes, exactly. Like you said, treat every space as if there's someone from every community there.
Right.
Be inclusive, because you don't know. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Maddie, for just being a part of this conversation and for taking the time to just share your knowledge and wisdom on this topic.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
If you are hearing this message right now, it means that you've listened to the entire episode. And for that, I would like to thank you all so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode just as much as we did. So until next time, keep conversing, keep engaging, and never stop learning.
Thank you for listening to the Inclusion First podcast. We are always collecting and answering your most important questions on anti-racism. So if there's something on your mind, head on over to the inclusionfirstproject.org and click on Ask a Question. We'd love for you to give us your like, your share, your follow, and especially your review, wherever you find us. Thank you so much again for listening, and we will talk to you next time.